You mustn't tell anyone what I'm about to tell you. Not Dad. Especially not Mum. Then I told her. I had to tell someone. There were many ways in which I disliked my sister. A few years ago, I could have shown you whole scribbled lists I'd written on that very topic. I hated her for the fact that she's got thick, straight hair, while mine breaks off if it grows beyond my shoulders. I hated her for the fact that you can never tell her anything that she doesn't already know. I hated her for the fact that for my whole school career, teachers insisted on telling me in hushed tones how bright she was. As if her brilliance wouldn't mean that by default I lived in a permanent shadow. I hated her for the fact that at the age of 26 I lived in a box room in a semi-detached house, just so she could have her illegitimate son in with her in the bigger bedroom. But every now and then I was very glad indeed that she was my sister. Because Katrina didn't shriek in horror. She didn't look shocked or insist that I tell Mum and Dad. She didn't once tell me I'd done the wrong thing by walking away. She took a huge swig of her drink. Jeez. Exactly. It's legal as well. It's not as if they can stop him. I know. Fuck. I can't even get my head around it. We downed two glasses just in the telling of it, and I could feel the heat rising in my cheeks. I hate the thought of leaving him, but I can't be part of this dream. I can't. She was thinking. My sister actually has a thinking face. It makes people wait before speaking to her. Dad says my thinking face makes it look like I want to go to the loo. I don't know what to do, I said. She looked up at me, her face suddenly brightening. It's simple. Simple. She poured us another glass each. Oops, we seem to have finished this already. Yes, simple. They've got money, right? I don't want their money. She offered me a raise. It's not the point. Shut up. Not for you, idiot girl. They'll have their own money, and he's probably got a shed load of insurance from the accident. Well, you tell them that you want a budget, and then you use that money, and you use the, what was it, 4 months you've got left, and you change Will Traynor's mind.
What?
You change his mind. You said he spends most of his time indoors, right? Well, start with something small. Then once you've got him out and about again, you think of every fabulous thing you could do for him. Everything that might make him want to live. Adventures, foreign travel, swimming with dolphins, whatever. And then you do it. I can help you. I'll look things up on the internet at the library. I bet we could come up with some brilliant things for him to do. Things that would really make him happy. I stared at her. Katrina.
Yeah, I know. She grinned as I started to smile.
I'm a fucking genius. Chapter 10. They looked a bit surprised. Actually, that's an understatement. Mrs. Traynor looked stunned, and then a bit disconcerted, and then her whole face closed off. Her daughter, curled up next to her on the sofa, just glowered. The kind of face Mum used to warn me would stick in place if the wind changed. It wasn't quite the enthusiastic response I'd been hoping for.
But what is it you actually want to do?
I don't know yet. My sister's good at researching stuff. She's trying to find out what's possible for quadriplegics. But I really wanted to find out from you whether you would be willing to go with it. We were in their drawing room. It was the same room I'd been interviewed in, except this time Mrs. Traynor and her daughter were perched on the sofa, their slobbery old dog between them. Mr. Traynor was standing by the fire.
I was wearing my French peasant's jacket and indigo denim, a mini-dress and a pair of army boots. With hindsight, I realized I could have picked a more professional-looking uniform in which to outline my plan.
"Let me get this straight." Camilla Traynor leaned forward. "You want to take Will away from this house?"
"Yes."
"And take him on a series of adventures?"
She said it like I was suggesting performing amateur keyhole surgery on him. "Yes. Like I said, I'm not sure what's possible yet. But it's about just getting him out and about, widening his horizons. There may be some local things we could do at first, and then hopefully something farther afield before too long."
"Are you talking about going abroad?"
"Abroad?" I blinked. "I was thinking more about maybe getting him to the pub, or to a show, just for starters."
"Will has barely left this house in 2 years, apart from hospital appointments."
"Well, yes. I thought I'd try and persuade him otherwise." "And you would, of course, go on all these adventures with him," Georgina Traynor said. "Look, it's nothing extraordinary. I'm really talking about just getting him out of the house to start with. A walk around the castle or a visit to the pub. If we end up swimming with dolphins in Florida, then that's lovely. But really, I just wanted to get him out of the house and thinking about something else." I didn't add that the mere thought of driving to the hospital in sole charge of Will was still enough to bring me out in a cold sweat. The thought of taking him abroad felt as likely as me running a marathon.
"I think it's a splendid idea," Mr. Traynor said. "I think it'd be marvellous to get Will out and about. You know it can't have been good for him, staring at the four walls day in and day out."
"We have tried to get him out, Stephen," Mrs. Traynor said. "It's not as if we've left him in there to rot. I've tried again and again."
"I know that, darling. But we haven't been terribly successful, have we? If Louisa here can think up things that Will is prepared to try, then that can only be a good thing, surely." "Yes, well, prepared to try being the operative phrase."
"It's just an idea," I said. I felt suddenly irritated. I could see what she was thinking.
"If you don't want me to do it,
you'll leave?"
She looked straight at me.
I didn't look away.
She didn't frighten me any more, because I knew now that she was no better than me. She was a woman who could sit back and let her son die right in front of her. "Yes, I probably will."
"So it's blackmail, Georgina."
"Well, let's not beat around the bush here, Daddy." I sat up a little straighter. "No, not blackmail. It's about what I'm prepared to be part of. I can't sit by and just quietly wait out the time until Will... well..." My voice trailed off. We all stared at our cups of tea.
"Like I said," Mr. Traynor said firmly, "I think it's a very good idea. If you can get Will to agree to it, I can't see that there's any harm at all. I'd love the idea of him going on holiday. Just let us know what you need us to do."
"I've got an idea." Mrs. Traynor put a hand on her daughter's shoulder. "Perhaps you could go on holiday with them, Georgina."
"Fine by me," I said. It was, because my chances of getting Will away on holiday were about the same as me competing on Mastermind.
Georgina Traynor shifted uncomfortably in her seat.
"I can't. You know I start my new job in 2 weeks. I won't be able to come over to England again for a bit once I've started."
"You're going back to Australia?"
"Don't sound so surprised. I did tell you this was just a visit."
"I just thought that, given recent events, you might want to stay here a bit longer."
Camilla Traynor stared at her daughter in a way she never stared at Will, no matter how rude he was to her.
"It's a really good job, Mummy. It's the one I've been working toward for the last 2 years."
She glanced over at her father.
"I can't put my whole life on hold just because of Will's mental state."
There was a long silence.
"This isn't fair. If it was me in the chair, would you have asked Will to put all his plans on hold?"
Mrs. Traynor didn't look at her daughter. I glanced down at my list, reading and rereading the first paragraph.
"I have a life too, you know."
It came out like a protest.
"Let's discuss this some other time."
Mr. Traynor's hand landed on his daughter's shoulder and squeezed it gently.
"Yes, let's."
Mrs. Traynor began to shuffle the papers in front of her.
"Right then.
I propose we do it like this.
I want to know everything you are planning," she said, looking up at me.
"I want to do the estimates, and if possible, I'd like a schedule so that I can try and plan some time off to come along with you. I have some unused holiday entitlement left that I can..." "No."
We all turned to look at Mr. Traynor. He was stroking the dog's head, and his expression was gentle, but his voice was firm.
"No, I don't think you should go, Camilla. Will should be allowed to do this by himself."
"Will can't do it by himself, Stephen.
There is an awful lot that needs to be considered when Will goes anywhere. It's complicated. I don't think we can really leave it to..." "No, darling," he repeated. "Nathan can help, and Louisa can manage just fine. But Will needs to be allowed to feel like a man. That's not going to be possible if his mother, or his sister for that matter, is always on hand."
I felt briefly sorry for Mrs. Traynor then. She still wore that haughty look of hers, but I could see underneath that she seemed a little lost, as if she couldn't quite understand what her husband was doing. Her hand went to her necklace. "I will make sure he's safe," I said. "And I will let you know everything we're planning on doing well in advance." Her jaw was so rigid that a little muscle was visible just underneath her cheekbone. I wondered if she actually hated me then. "I want Will to want to live too," I said finally.
"We do understand that," Mr. Traynor said. "And we do appreciate your determination. And discretion."
I wondered whether that word was in relation to Will or to something else entirely. And then he stood up, and I realized that it was my signal to leave. Georgina and her mother still sat on the sofa, saying nothing. I got the feeling there was going to be a whole lot more conversation once I was out of the room.
"Right then," I said. "I'll draw you up the paperwork as soon as I've worked it all out in my head. It'll be soon. We haven't much..."
Mr. Traynor patted my shoulder.
"I know. Just let us know what you come up with," he said.
Trina was blowing on her hands, her feet moving involuntarily up and down as if marching on the spot. She was wearing my dark green beret, which, annoyingly, looked much better on her than it did on me. She leaned over and pointed to the list she'd just pulled from her pocket, and handed it to me.
"You're probably going to have to scratch number 3, or at least put that off until it gets warmer."
I checked the list.
"Quadriplegic basketball? I'm not even sure if he likes basketball."
"That's not the point."
"Bloody hell, it's cold up here."
She pulled the beret lower over her ears.
"The point is, it'll give him a chance to see what's possible. He can see that there are other people just as bad off as he is who are doing sports and things."
"I'm not sure. He can't even lift a cup. I think these people must be paraplegic. I can't see that you could throw a ball without the use of your arms."
"You're missing the point.
He doesn't have to actually do anything. But it's about widening his horizons, right? We're letting him see what other handicapped people are doing.
If you say so. A low murmur rose in the crowd. The runners had been sighted some distance away. If I went on to tiptoes, I could just make them out, probably 2 miles away, down in the valley, a small block of bobbing white dots forcing their way through the cold along a damp, grey road. I glanced at my watch. We had been standing here on the brow of the aptly named Windy Hill for almost 40 minutes, and I could no longer feel my feet. I've looked up what's local, and if he didn't want to drive too far, there's a match at the sports centre in a couple of weeks. He could even have a bet on the result.
Betting?
That way he could get a bit involved without even having to play. Oh, look, there they are. How long do you think they'll take to get to us?
We stood near the finish line. Above our heads, a tarpaulin banner announcing the spring triathlon finish line flapped wanly in the stiff breeze.
Dunno. 20 minutes? Longer? I've got an emergency Mars bar if you want to share.
I reached into my pocket. It was impossible to stop the list from flapping.
So what else did you come up with? You said you wanted to go farther afield, right?
She pointed to my fingers.
You've given yourself the bigger bit.
Oh, take this bit, then.
I think the family thinks I'm freeloading.
What? Because you want to take him on a few crummy days out?
Jesus.
They should be grateful someone's making the effort. It's not like they are. Trina took the other piece of Mars bar.
Anyway, number 5, I think it is. There's a computer course that he could do. They put a thing on their head with, like, a stick on it, and they nod their head to touch the keyboard. There are loads of quadriplegic groups online. He could make lots of new friends that way. It would mean he doesn't always have to actually leave the house. I even spoke to a couple in the chat rooms. They seem nice.
Quite, she shrugged,
normal.
We ate our Mars bar halves in silence, watching as the group of miserable-looking runners drew closer. I couldn't see Patrick. I never could. He had the kind of face that became instantly invisible in crowds. She pointed to the bit of paper.
Anyway, head for the cultural section. There's a concert specially for people with disabilities here.
You said he's cultured, right?
Well, he could just sit there and be transported by the music.
That's meant to take you out of yourself, right?
Derek, with the mustache at work, told me about it. He said it can get noisy because of the really disabled people who yell a bit, but I'm sure he'd still enjoy it.
I wrinkled my nose. I don't know, Trine.
You're just frightened because I said culture.
You only have to sit there with him, and not rustle your crisp packet.
Or if you fancied something a bit saucier.
She grinned at me.
There's a strip club. You could take him to London for that.
Take my employer to watch a stripper?
Well, you say you do everything else for him, all the cleaning and feeding and stuff. I can't see why you wouldn't just sit by him while he gets a stiffy.
Trina!
Well, he must miss it. You could even buy him a lap dance. Several people around us in the crowd swiveled their heads. My sister was laughing. She could talk about sex like that, like it was some kind of recreational activity, like it didn't matter. And then on the other side there are the bigger trips. Don't know what you fancied, but you could do wine tasting in the Loire. That's not too far, for starters.
Can quadriplegics get drunk?
I don't know. Ask him.
I frowned at the list. So, I'll go back and tell the trainers that I'm going to get their suicidal quadriplegic son drunk, spend their money on strippers and lap dancers, and then trundle them off to the Disability Olympics.
Trina snatched the list back from me.
Well, I don't see you coming up with anything more bloody inspirational.
I just thought, I don't know. I rubbed at my nose.
I'm feeling a bit daunted, to be honest. I have trouble even persuading him to go into the garden.
Well, that's hardly the attitude, is it?
Oh, look, here they come. We better smile. Go, Patrick, I yelled weakly. He didn't see me, and he flashed by toward the finish line. Trina didn't talk to me for 2 days after I failed to show the required enthusiasm for her to-do list. My parents didn't notice. They were just overjoyed to hear that I'd decided not to leave my job. Management had called a series of meetings at the furniture factory for the end of that week, and Dad was convinced that he'd be among those made redundant. Nobody over the age of 40 had yet survived the cull. "We're very grateful for your housekeeping, love," Mum said, so often that it made me feel a bit uncomfortable. It was a funny week. Trina began packing for her course, and each day I had to sneak upstairs to go through the bags she'd already packed to see which of my possessions she planned to take with her. Most of my clothes were safe, but so far I'd recovered a hairdryer, my fake Prada sunglasses, and my favorite wash bag with the lemons on it. If I confronted her over any of it, she would just shrug and say, "Well, you never use it," as if that were entirely the point. That was Trina all over. She felt entitled. Even though Thomas had come along, she had never quite lost that sense of being the baby of the family, the deep-rooted feeling that the whole world actually did revolve around her. When we were little, and she threw a huge tantrum because she wanted something of mine, Mum would plead with me to just let her have it, if only for some peace in the house. Nearly 20 years later, nothing had really changed. We had to babysit Thomas so that Trina could still go out, feed him so that Trina didn't have to worry, buy her extra nice presents at birthdays and Christmas, because Thomas means she often goes without. Well, she could go without my bloody lemons wash bag. I stuck a note on my door that read, "My stuff is mine. Go away." Trina ripped it off and told Mum I was the biggest child she had ever met and that Thomas had more maturity in his little finger than I did. But it got me thinking. One evening, after Trina had gone out to her night class, I sat in the kitchen while Mum sorted Dad's shirts ready for ironing. "Mum?"
"Yes, love?"
"Do you think I can move into Trina's room once she's gone?" Mum paused, a half-folded shirt pressed to her chest.
"I don't know.
I hadn't really thought about it. I mean, if she and Thomas aren't going to be here, it's only fair that I should be allowed a proper-sized bedroom. It seems silly, it sitting empty, if they're going off to college." Mum nodded and placed the shirt carefully in the laundry basket. "I suppose you're right. And by rights, that room should have been mine, what with me being the elder and all. It's only because she had Thomas that she got it at all." She could see the sense in it. "That's true. I'll talk to Trina about it," she said. "I suppose with hindsight it would have been a good idea to mention it to my sister first." 3 hours later she came bursting into the living room with a face like thunder. "Would you jump in my grave so quickly?" Grandad jerked awake in his chair, his hand reflexively clasped to his chest. I looked up from the television. "What are you talking about?" "Where are me and Thomas supposed to go on weekends? We can't both fit in the box room. There's not even enough room in there for 2 beds. "Exactly. And I've been stuck in there for 5 years. The knowledge that I was ever so slightly in the wrong made me sound pricklier than I'd intended. "You can't take my room. It's not fair. You're not even going to be in it. But I need it. There's no way me and Thomas can fit in the box room. Dad, tell her." Dad's chin descended to somewhere deep in his collar, his arms folded across his chest. He hated it when we fought,
intended to leave it to Mum to sort out.
"Turn it down a bit, girls," he said.
"I don't believe you. No wonder you were so keen to help me leave."
"What? So you begging me to keep my job so that I can help you out financially is now part of my sinister plan, is it?"
"You're so two-faced."
"Katrina, calm down." Mum appeared in the doorway, her rubber gloves dripping foamy water onto the living room carpet. "We can talk about this calmly. I don't want you getting Grandad all wound up."
Katrina's face had gone blotchy, the way it did when she was small and she didn't get her way.
"She actually wants me to go. That's what this is. She can't wait for me to go because she's jealous that I'm actually doing something with my life. So she just wants to make it difficult for me to come home again."
"There's no guarantee you're even going to be coming home on the weekends," I yelled, stung.
"I need a bedroom, not a cupboard. And you've had the best room the whole time, just because you were dumb enough to get yourself up the duff."
"Louisa," said Mum.
"Yes, well, if you weren't so thick that you can't even get a proper job, you could have gotten your own bloody place. You're old enough. Oh, what's the matter? You finally figured out that Patrick is never going to ask you?"
"That's it!"
Dad's roar broke into the silence.
"I've heard enough. Trina, go into the kitchen. Lou, sit down and shut up. I've got enough stress in my life without having to listen to you caterwauling at each other."
"If you think I'm helping you now with your stupid list, you've got another thing coming," Trina hissed at me, as Mum manhandled her out the door.
"Good. I didn't want your help anyway, freeloader," I said, and then ducked as Dad threw a copy of the Radio Times at my head.
On Saturday morning, I went to the library. I think I probably hadn't been in there since I was at school, quite possibly out of fear that they would remember the Judy Bloom I'd lost in Year 7, and that a clammy, official hand would reach out as I passed through the building's Victorian pillared doors, demanding £3,853 in fines. It wasn't what I remembered. Half the books seemed to have been replaced by CDs and DVDs, great bookshelves full of audiobooks, and even stands of greeting cards. And it was not silent. The sound of singing and clapping filtered through from the children's book corner, where some kind of mother and baby group was in full swing. People read magazines and chattered quietly. The section where old men used to fall asleep over the free newspapers had disappeared, replaced by a large oval table with computers dotted around the perimeter. I sat down gingerly at one of these, hoping that nobody was watching. Computers, like books, are my sister's thing. Luckily, they seemed to have anticipated the sheer terror felt by people like me. A librarian stopped by my table and handed me a card and a laminated sheet with instructions on it. She didn't stand over my shoulder, just murmured that she would be at the desk if I needed any further help. And then it was just me and a chair with a wonky caster and the blank screen. The only computer I've had any contact with in years is Patrick's. He only really uses it to download fitness plans or to order sports technique books from Amazon. If there is other stuff he does on there, I don't really want to know about it. But I followed the librarian's instructions, double-checking every stage as I completed it. And astonishingly, it worked. It didn't just work, but it was easy. 4 hours later, I had the beginnings of my list. And nobody mentioned the Judy Bloom. Mind you, that was probably because I'd used my sister's library card. On the way home, I nipped into the stationer's and bought a wall calendar, the sort you might find in an office, with staff holiday entitlement marked on it in permanent pen. In my little room at home, I opened it out, pinned it carefully to the back of my door, and marked the date when I had started at the trainer's, way back at the beginning of February. Then I counted forward and marked the date, August 12th, now barely 4 months ahead. I took a step back and stared at it for a while, trying to make the little black ring bear some of the weight of what it heralded. And as I stared, I began to realize what I was taking on. I would have to fill those little white rectangles with a lifetime of things that could generate happiness, contentment, satisfaction, or pleasure. I would have to fill them with every good experience I could summon up, for a man whose powerless arms and legs meant he could no longer make them happen by himself. I had just under 4 months' worth of printed rectangles to pack with days out, trips away, visitors, lunches and concerts. I had to come up with all the practical ways to make them happen, and do enough research to make sure that they didn't fail. And then I had to convince Will to actually do them. I stared at my calendar, the pen stilled in my hand. This little patch of paper suddenly bore a whole heap of responsibility. I had 117 days in which to convince Will Traynor that he had a reason to live. Chapter 11. There are places where the changing seasons are marked by migrating birds, or the ebb and flow of tides. Here, in our little town, it was the return of the tourists. At first a tentative trickle, stepping off trains or out of cars in brightly coloured waterproof coats, clutching their guidebooks and National Trust membership. Then, as the air warmed and the season crept forward, disgorged alongside the belch and hiss of their coaches clogging up the high street, Americans, Japanese, and packs of foreign schoolchildren dotted the perimeter of the castle. In the winter, little stayed open. The wealthier shop owners took advantage of the long bleak months to disappear to holiday homes abroad, while the more determined hosted Christmas events, capitalizing on occasional carol concerts on the grounds or festive craft fairs. But then, as the temperatures rose, the castle car parks would become studded with vehicles, the local pubs would chalk up an increase in requests for a ploughman's lunch, and within a few sunny Sundays, we had morphed again from being a sleepy market town into a traditional English tourist destination. I walked up the hill, dodging this season's hovering early few as they clutched their neoprene fanny packs and well-thumbed tourist guides, their cameras already poised to capture mementos of the castle in spring. I smiled at a few, paused to take photographs of others with proffered cameras. Some locals complained about the tourist season, the traffic jams, the overwhelmed public toilets, the demands for strange comestibles in the buttered bun cafe.
"You don't do sushi? Not even hand roll?"
But I didn't. I liked the breath of foreign air, the close-up glimpses of lives far removed from my own. I liked to hear the accents and work out where their owners came from, to study the clothes of people who'd never seen a Next catalogue or bought a 5-pack of knickers at Marks and Spencer.
"You look cheerful," Will said, as I dropped my bag in the hallway. He said it as if it were almost an affront.
"That's because it's today."
"What is?"
"Our outing. We're taking Nathan to see the horse racing."
Will and Nathan looked at each other.
I almost laughed. I'd been so relieved at the sight of the weather. Once I saw the sun, I knew everything was going to be all right.
"Horse racing?"
"Yep. Flat racing at..." I pulled my notepad from my pocket. "Longfield. If we leave now, we can be there in time for the third race. And I have £5 each way on Man O' Man, so we better get a move on."
"Horse racing?"
"Yes, Nathan's never been." In honour of the occasion, I was wearing my blue quilted mini-dress,
with the scarf with horse bits around the edge knotted at my neck, and a pair of leather riding boots. Will studied me carefully, then reversed his chair and swerved so that he could better see his male caregiver.
"This is a long-held desire of yours, is it, Nathan?"
I gave Nathan a warning glare.
"Yes," he said, and broke out in a smile. "Yes, it is. Let's head for the ponies."
I had primed him, of course. I'd rung him on Friday and asked him which day I could borrow him. The trainers had agreed to pay his extra hours. Will's sister had left for Australia, and I think they wanted to be sure that someone sensible was going to accompany me. But I hadn't been sure until Sunday what it actually was we were going to do. This seemed the ideal start. A nice day out, less than half an hour's drive away.
"And what if I say I don't want to go?"
"Then you owe me £40, I said.
£40? How do you work that out?
My winnings. £5 each way at 8-1. I shrugged. Man o' man's a sure thing. I seem to have got him off balance.
Nathan clapped his hands onto his knees. "Sounds great. Nice day for it, too," he said. "You want me to pack some lunch?"
"Nah," I said. "There's a nice restaurant. When my horse comes in, lunch is on me."
"You've been racing often, then?" Will said.
And then before he could say anything else, we had him bundled into his coat, and I ran outside to reverse the car. I had it all planned, you see. We would arrive at the racecourse on a beautiful, sunny day. There would be burnished, stick-legged thoroughbreds, their jockeys in billowing bright silks careering past. Perhaps a brass band or two. The stands would be full of cheering people, and we would find a space from which to wave our winning betting slips. Will's competitive streak would kick in, and he'd be unable to resist calculating the odds and making sure he won more than either Nathan or me. I had worked it all out. And then, when we'd had enough of watching the horses, we would go to the well-reviewed racecourse restaurant and have a slap-up meal. I should have listened to my father.
"Want to know the true definition of the triumph of hope over experience?" he would say. "Plan a fun family day out."
It started with the car park. I drove there without incident, now a little more confident that I wasn't going to tip Will over if I went faster than 15 miles per hour. I kept up a cheerful banter almost the whole way there, commenting on the beautiful blue sky, the countryside, the lack of traffic. There were no queues to enter the racecourse, which was, admittedly, a little less grand than I'd expected, and the car park was clearly marked. But nobody had warned me it was on grass, and grass that had been driven over for much of a wet winter at that. We backed into a space, not hard, as it was only half full, and almost as soon as the ramp was down, Nathan looked worried.
"It's too soft," he said. "He's going to sink."
I glanced over at the stands. "Surely if we can get him onto that pathway, we'll be okay."
"It weighs a ton, this chair," he said. "And that's 40 feet away."
"Oh, come on. They must build these chairs to withstand a bit of soft ground." I backed Will's chair down carefully, and then watched as the wheel sank several inches into the mud. Will said nothing. He looked uncomfortable, and had been silent for much of the half-hour drive. "Come on," I said. "We'll do it manually. I'm sure between us we can manage to get there." We tilted Will backward. I took one handle, and Nathan took the other, and we dragged the chair toward the path. It was slow progress. I had to keep stopping because my arms hurt, and my pristine boots grew thick with mud. When we finally made it to the pathway, Will's blanket had half slipped off him and had somehow got caught up in his wheels, leaving one corner torn and muddy.
"Don't worry," Will said dryly. "It's only cashmere."
I ignored him.
"Right, we've made it. Now for the fun bit."
Ah, yes, the fun bit. Who thought it would be a good idea for racecourses to have turnstiles? It was hardly as if they needed crowd control. We looked at the turnstile, and then back at Will's chair, and then Nathan and I looked at each other. Nathan stepped over to the ticket office and explained our plight to the woman inside. She tilted her head to look at Will, then pointed us toward the far end of the stand.
"The disabled entrance is over there," she said.
She said disabled like someone entering a diction contest. It was a good 200 yards away.
By the time we finally made it over there, the blue skies had disappeared abruptly, replaced by a sudden squall. Naturally, I hadn't brought an umbrella.
I kept up a relentless, cheerful commentary about how funny this was and how ridiculous. And even to my ears, I'd begun to sound brittle and irritating.
"Clark," said Will finally, "just chill out, okay? You're being exhausting." We bought tickets for the stands, and then, almost faint with relief at finally having gotten there, I wheeled Will out to a sheltered area just to the side of the main stand. While Nathan sorted out Will's drink, I had some time to look at our fellow racegoers. Above us, on a glass-fronted balcony, men in suits proffered champagne glasses to women in wedding outfits. They looked warm and cozy, and I guessed that was the premier area, listed next to some stratospheric price on the board in the ticket kiosk. They wore little badges on red thread, marking them out as special. I wondered briefly if it was possible to colour our blue ones a different shade, but decided that being the only people with a wheelchair would probably make us a little conspicuous. Beside us, dotted along the stands and clutching polystyrene cups of coffee and hip flasks, were men in tweedy suits and women in smart padded coats. They looked a little more every day and wore blue badges like ours. And then, like some parody of a class system, around the parade ring stood a group of men in striped polo shirts who clutched beer cans and seemed to be on some kind of outing. Their shaved heads suggested military service. Periodically they would break out into song, or begin some noisy physical altercation, ramming one another with blunt heads, or wrapping their arms around one another's necks. As I passed to go to the loo, they catcalled, and I flipped them the finger behind my back. And then they lost interest, as 7 or 8 horses began skirting around one another, and they eased into the stands with workmanlike skill, all preparing for the next race. And then I jumped, as around us the small crowd roared into life and the horses bolted from the starting gate. I stood and watched them go, suddenly transfixed, unable to suppress a flurry of excitement at the tails suddenly streaming out behind them, the frantic efforts of the brightly coloured men atop them, all jostling for position. When the winner crossed the finish line, it was almost impossible not to cheer. We watched the Sisterwood Cup, and then the Maiden Stakes, and Nathan won £6 on a small each-way bet. Will declined to bet. He watched each race, but he was silent, his head retracted into the high collar of his jacket. I thought perhaps he'd been indoors so long that it was all bound to feel a little weird for him, and I decided I was simply not going to acknowledge it.
"So how many races will it take to ensure we've fulfilled your long-held ambitions?"
"Don't be grumpy. They say you should try everything once," I said.
"I think horse racing falls into the except incest and Morris dancing category.
You're the one always telling me to widen my horizons.
You're loving it, I said, and don't pretend otherwise.
And then they were off. Man O' Man was in purple silks with a yellow diamond. I watched him flatten out around the white rail, the horse's head extended, the jockey's legs pumping, arms flailing backward and forward up the horse's neck.
Go on, mate!
Nathan had gotten into it despite himself. His fists were clenched, his eyes fixed on the blurred group of animals speeding around the far side of the track.
Go on, man, oh man! I yelled. We've got a steak dinner riding on you!
I watched him vainly, trying to make ground, his nostrils dilated, his ears back against his head. My own heart lurched into my mouth. And then, as they reached the final furlong, my yelling began to die away.
All right, a coffee, I said. I'll settle for a coffee.
Around me, the stands had erupted into shouting and screaming. A girl was bouncing up and down two seats away from us, her voice hoarse with screeching. I found I was bouncing on my toes. And then I looked down and saw that Will's eyes were closed, a faint furrow separating his brows. I tore my attention from the track and knelt down. Are you okay, Will? I said, moving close to him. Do you need something?
Scotch, he said. Large one.
He lifted his eyes to mine. He looked utterly fed up.
Let's get some lunch, I said to Nathan.
Man O' Man, that four-legged imposter, flashed past the finish line a miserable sixth. There was another cheer, and the announcer's voice came over the loudspeaker.
Ladies and gentlemen, an emphatic win there from Love Be a Lady. There in first place, followed by Winter Sun, and Barney Rubble, two lengths behind, in third place.
I pushed Will's chair through the oblivious groups of people, deliberately bashing into heels when they failed to react to my second, "Excuse me." We were just at the lift when I heard Will's voice.
Sir Clark, does this mean you owe me £40?
The restaurant had been refurbished, the food now under the auspices of a television chef whose face appeared on posters around the racecourse. I had looked up the menu beforehand. The signature dish is duck in orange sauce, I told the two men. It's 70s retro, apparently.
Like your outfit, said Will.
Out of the cold and away from the crowds, he appeared to have cheered up a little. He'd begun to look around him instead of retreating back into his solitary world. My stomach began to rumble, already anticipating a good hot lunch. Will's mother had given us £80 as a float. I decided I would pay for my food myself and show her the receipt, and as a result had no fears at all that I was going to order myself whatever I fancied on the menu, retro roast duck or otherwise.
You like going out to eat, Nathan, I said.
I'm more of a beer and takeaway man myself, Nathan said. Happy to come today, though.
When did you last go out for a meal, Will? I said.
He and Nathan looked at each other.
Not while I've been there, Nathan said. Strangely, I'm not overly fond of being spoon-fed in front of strangers.
Then we'll get a table where we can face you away from the room, I said.
I'd anticipated this one. And if any celebrities are here, that will be your loss.
Because celebrities are thick on the ground at a muddy minor racecourse in March.
You're not going to spoil this for me, Will Traynor, I said, as the lift doors opened. The last time I ate out anywhere was a birthday party for four-year-olds at Halesbury's only indoor bowling alley, and there wasn't a thing that wasn't covered in batter, including the children. We wheeled our way down the carpeted corridor. The restaurant ran along one side behind a glass wall, and I could see there were plenty of free tables. "Hello," I said, stepping up to the reception area. "I'd like a table for three, please." "Please don't look at Will," I told the woman silently. "Don't make him feel awkward. It's important that he enjoy this." "Badge, please," she said. "Sorry?" "Your premier area badge?" I looked at her blankly. "This restaurant is for premier badge holders only." I glanced behind me at Will and Nathan. They couldn't hear me, but stood expectantly waiting. Nathan was helping remove Will's coat. "I didn't know we couldn't eat anywhere we wanted. We have the blue badges." She smiled. "Sorry," she said. "Only premier badge holders. It does say so on all our promotional material." I took a deep breath. "Okay. Are there any other restaurants?" "I'm afraid the weighing room, our relaxed dining area, is being refurbished right now, but there are stalls along the stands where you can get something to eat." She saw my face fall and added, "The pig in a poke is pretty good. You get a hog roast in a bun. They do applesauce, too." "A stall?" "Yes." I leaned in toward her. "Please," I said. "We've come a long way, and my friend there isn't good in the cold. Is there any way at all that we could get a table in here? We just really need to get him into the warm. It's really important that he has a good day." She wrinkled her nose. "I'm really sorry," she said. "It's more than my job's worth to override the rules. But there is a disabled seating area downstairs that you can shut the doors on. You can't see the course, but it's quite snug." I stared at her. I could feel the tension creeping upward from my shins. I studied her name badge. "Sharon," I said. "You haven't even begun to fill your tables. Surely it would be better to have more people eating than leaving half these tables empty, just because of some arcane, class-based regulation in a rule book." Her smile glinted under the recessed lighting. "Madam, I have explained the situation to you. If we relaxed the rules for you, we'd have to do it for everyone. It's a wet Monday lunchtime. You have empty tables. We want to buy a meal. A properly expensive meal with napkins and everything. We don't want to eat pork rolls and sit in a cloakroom with no view, no matter how snug." Other diners had begun to turn in their seats, curious about the altercation by the door. I could see Will looking embarrassed now. He and Nathan had worked out that something was going wrong. "Then I'm afraid you should have bought a premier area badge." "Okay." I reached for my handbag and began to rifle through, searching for my purse. "How much is a premier area badge? Tissues, old bus tickets, and one of Thomas's Hot Wheels toy cars flew out. I no longer cared. I was going to get Will his posh lunch in a restaurant. Here. How much? Another 10? 20? I thrust a fistful of notes at her. She looked down at my hand. "I'm sorry, madam. We don't sell badges here. This is a restaurant. You'll have to go back to the ticket office." "The one that's all the way over at the other side of the racecourse?" "Yes." We stared at each other. Will's voice broke in. "Louisa, let's go." I felt my eyes suddenly brim with tears. "No," I said. "This is ridiculous. We've come all this way.
You stay here, and I'll go and get us all Premier Area badges, and then we will have our meal.
Louisa, I'm not hungry.
We'll be fine once we've eaten. We can watch the horses and everything. It'll be fine.
Nathan stepped forward and laid a hand on my arm. Louisa, I think Will really just wants to go home.
We were now the focus of the whole restaurant. The gaze of the diners swept over us and travelled past me to Will, where they clouded with faint pity or distaste. I felt like an utter failure. I looked up at the woman, who did at least have the grace to look slightly embarrassed now that Will had actually spoken.
"Well, thank you," I said to her. "Thanks for being so fucking accommodating."
"Clark," Will's voice carried a warning.
"So glad that you are so flexible. I'll certainly recommend you to everyone I know."
"Louisa." I grabbed my bag and thrust it under my arm.
"You've forgotten your little car," she called, as I swept through the door that Nathan held open for me. "Why, does that need a bloody badge too?" I said, and followed them into the lift.
We descended in silence. I spent most of the short lift journey trying to stop my hands from shaking with rage. We ordered 3 buns with pork, crackling and applesauce, and sheltered under the striped awning while we ate them. I perched on a small dustbin, so that I could be at the same level as Will, and helped him to manageable bites of meat, shredding it with my fingers when necessary. The 2 women who served behind the counter pretended not to look at us. I could see them monitoring Will out of the corners of their eyes, periodically muttering to each other when they thought we weren't looking. "Poor man," I could practically hear them saying. "What a terrible way to live." I tried not to think too hard about what Will must be feeling. The rain had stopped, but the wind-swept course felt suddenly bleak, its brown and green surface littered with discarded betting slips, its horizon flat and empty. The car park had thinned out with the rain, and in the distance we could just hear the distorted sound of the loudspeaker as some other race thundered past.
"I think maybe we should head back," Nathan said, wiping his mouth. "I mean, it was nice and all, but best to miss the traffic, eh?"
"Didn't he like it?" said one of the women, as Nathan began to wheel him away across the grass. "I don't know. Perhaps he would have liked it better if it hadn't come with a side order of rubberneck," I said, and chucked the remnants hard into the bin. But getting to the car and back up the ramp was easier said than done. In the few hours that we'd spent at the racecourse, the arrivals and departures meant that the car park had turned into a sea of mud. Even with Nathan's impressive might and my best shoulder, we couldn't get the chair even halfway across the grass to the car. The wheels skidded and whined, unable to get the purchase to make it up that last couple of inches. My feet and Nathan's slithered in the mud, which worked its way up the sides of our shoes.
"It's not going to happen," said Will. "I think we're going to need some help," Nathan said. "I can't even get the chair back onto the path. It's stuck."
Will let out an audible sigh. He looked about as fed up as I'd ever seen him.
"I could lift you into the front seat, Will, if I'd tilt it back a little, and then Louisa and I could see if we could get the chair in afterward."
Will's voice emerged through gritted teeth. "I am not ending today with a fireman's lift."
"Sorry, mate," Nathan said.
"But Lou and I aren't going to be able to manage this alone."
"Here, Lou, you're prettier than I am. Go and collar a few extra pairs of arms, will you?"
Will closed his eyes, set his jaw, and I ran toward the stands. I'm not usually good with strangers.